to case number 3. And that's 082520, United States versus Hernandez Arenado. Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Samantha Heifetz for the United States. The Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act of 2006 seeks to ensure that the Federal Bureau of Prisons is not required to release from its custody persons who present a sexual danger to children as a result of their mental conditions. The Act therefore authorizes the government to seek the civil commitment of what the Act terms sexually dangerous persons who are in the Bureau's custody. Mr. Hernandez, in this case, the court did not determine that Mr. Hernandez Arenado, the respondent appellee, is a sexually dangerous person as defined by the Act. It concluded instead that he did not satisfy the threshold criteria of being, quote, a person in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons. And as a result, that is the issue presented here on appeal. Mr. Hernandez Arenado, yes?
He has been in a federal prison for 20 years, various ones in 6 or 7 different states. And as I understand, you know, this is only a 10-minute argument case, but we're going to be concerned with what is the meaning of the word custody.
That is correct.
I would think the ordinary meaning of that, and all the legal mumbo-jumbo aside, but if you've been inside the walls of a federal prison for 20 years, you've been in the custody of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. They feed you, they clothe you, they see to your medical needs. Why isn't that the way to properly look at this case?
Absolutely.
And not say, well, they're really holding him for the INS. They're doing a favor to the INS by holding him. So
I think that's absolutely correct, Your Honor. The Mr. Hernandez Arenado does not dispute that he falls within all of the common uses of the word custody. He doesn't argue in his briefs that he is outside of Black's Law Dictionary's definition, the care and control of a person for the purposes of, you know, security, preservation, inspection, etc. Indeed, notably, Black's Law doesn't draw the type of distinction between physical custody and legal custody that he seems to perhaps be suggesting. The only way in which there's any distinction drawn is in the family law context, where Black's notes that legal custody connotes decision-making authority, where physical custody is caregiving authority. But once again, it's quite clear in this case that the Bureau of Prisons has exercised both of those forms of authority vis-a-vis Mr. Hernandez Arenado. They have, for example, transferred him on various occasions. And I note that particular form of authority because Mr. Hernandez Arenado, in attempting to make a plain meaning argument, raises the specter of 18 U.S.C. 3621, and for the most part, that's simply a red herring. Of course, the language, it's not referenced in the Adam Walsh Act. 4248 does not make reference to 3621. So if Congress had intended for 3621 to circumscribe the universe of persons subject to the Adam Walsh Act, they could have referenced 3621. They do not.
Why doesn't the government go to Congress and, say, clear up this definition of custody to include anyone who is there by virtue of some order of another agency of the federal government as the INS?
That simply does not seem to be necessary, Your Honor, because he does
fall. It's necessary if you lose this case.
If that's the case, that may well be what Congress does in response. However, at this time, you know, we have the vast majority of persons who are in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons are there pursuant to a criminal conviction. That is the case. There is no question that Mr. Hernandez Arenado represents an exceptional route to being in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons. He came through originally in 1980 under the authority of the Attorney General to detain, and that authority was subsequently transferred to the Department of Homeland Security, whereas typically prisoners are arrested pursuant to the authority of the Attorney General and then sentenced by a court and thus find their way into the Bureau's custody. So there's no question that this is an exceptional route, and there are only a handful of persons in this position. I understand that at this time there are approximately 12 or 13.
Are they all from the Cuban?
Yeah, there are approximately 12 or 13 long-term detainees who are these Mariel Cubans who have been determined to be specially dangerous. That's the language of the regulation.
But have any of them been subject to the Adam Walsh?
Only Mr. Hernandez Arenado, as far as I am aware.
The other ones were not convicted of a sex crime.
I don't have information about their status, so I couldn't answer that question. But the fact that he has come through this exceptional route certainly, first of all, does not suggest that he was not within the intended scope of Congress in terms of who's in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons. He hasn't suggested any reason to consider him otherwise. But importantly, you know, there is good reason to believe that Congress did, in fact, intend for the statute to reach persons like Mr. Hernandez Arenado, detained Mariel Cubans who have been determined to be specially dangerous.
But then aren't we necessarily also including anyone in the physical custody of the BOP, including those who are, you know, housed there as material witnesses, under civil contempt, under contracts with state or local governments?
No,
I've been trying to figure out how it could be interpreted otherwise.
Absolutely, Your Honor. No, it's certainly not the government does not and need not take the position here that absolutely any person who's found in a BOP facility, regardless of how they got there and the nature and the duration of their status, is subject to the act. The question is what Congress intended.
What's the line?
Absolutely.
Here's the line.
Here's
what's bothering us, I think. You've got a pretrial confinee in the MCC. He's been there a while, and your case falls apart, and you don't want to let him go. So you get him certified, and he goes away.
Well,
that's what we're afraid of.
The question is most certainly what did Congress intend when they said in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons? And I cannot suggest to you that the Bureau is prepared to offer a singular comprehensive definition for all times and all places. But what I certainly can say is, and that, you know, the fact that we may be able to conceive of a case where the application of 18 U.S.C. 4248 would raise legal concerns, statutory or constitutional, you know, that does not mean that this is such a case. So what we have presented here is someone who seems to fall easily within the scope intended by Congress. And there's some specifics of this case that may help to address your question. If I may, Your Honor, the 1999 BOP program statement, which the district court did not discuss and which the Supreme Court in Reno versus Correa indicated is entitled to deference, as akin to an interpretive rule, makes very clear that the Bureau has long considered persons in this particular status, that is, Mariel Cubans who have been detained, in this case who are determined to be specially dangerous, that they are considered to be in custody. Indeed, the statement accords them the second highest security level of prisoners, just below maximum security. And it makes clear that they're required to abide by BOP policies and that the BOP has authority over them. Now, okay. In that statement, it notes that authority goes back actually to 1980. Yeah. Yes, Your Honor.
I know why you're rushing, because you have so little time. I'm going to give
15
you,
minutes
I'm
gonna, in,
yeah,
out of her 10. So.
I'm going to give you, you know, some. I'll give you more time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
There really are some things that we
absolutely,
we need to get through here. You see, in effect, what you're doing, it seems to me, is you're dismissing the class of persons that we've all sort of noted as maybe difficult cases that aren't really before us right now.
Indeed.
But you see, if that's the logical and unavoidable consequence of the statutory interpretation that you're seeking, and it extends the reach far beyond the persons that were contemplated by the legislature, then doesn't that weigh, you know, against your interpretation? But believe me, I understand, and we all understand.
We're not suggesting a definition that is simply a black and white issue of physical custody versus some form of authority to detain. In the situations that, for example, that one might contemplate as difficult cases, i.e. a material witness or someone under a contempt order, I note for a moment that the internal memorandum of BOP that appellee cites to already notes that the Bureau does not consider those people to fall within does not consider those people to be subject to review for certification. So look, in a difficult case in the first instance, it would come to the Bureau, and then it would be up to a court to review. And what we're suggesting is that those cases are distinguishable. They're simply not presented here. And what we do have is a case that falls easily within the scope of the statute for the reasons to begin with that Judge Evans pointed out, and additional reasons that perhaps we can get to in rebuttal. But the red light is on, so I will.
Don't worry.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Good morning, Ms. Day.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. I'm appearing on behalf of Mr. Hernandez-Arenado this morning. I think the Court got right to the essence of what the problem is here. What is the definition of custody?
And I was... Let me ask you this. Are you representing him in this appeal of the habeas corpus decision out of Kansas?
No. No, I'm not. The Federal Defender's Office for the District of Kansas is representing him there.
If that decision is reversed, this case really becomes moot, doesn't it?
I believe it does, and I think that also goes to the heart of the problem here. The Bureau of Prisons has stepped in, I think, probably in fear that the district court decision in Kansas was going to be upheld. The district court in Kansas clearly believes that the INS is the proper party for determining the appropriateness for detention or release of Mr. Hernandez. So the Bureau of Prisons has taken a gigantic leap of faith in saying, well, no, you don't, INS, have that custody, which means the Tenth Circuit doesn't.
You look at this as a protective proceeding in case the government doesn't prevail in the Tenth Circuit.
And yes, I can see that they would want to come in and say, well, just in case. And I think that probably explains why he was moved during the course of the proceedings from Kansas to Illinois.
What is the position of the government in the Tenth Circuit appeal? What is their position before the Tenth Circuit?
The government has raised an issue of Chevron deference to the underlying statute that is at issue there, which was interpreted by the Supreme Court in Zadvydas and further in Martinez regarding the release of detainees. The Zadvydas decision dictated that immigration detainees should be released within 6 months if there is no thought that they can be returned, repatriated to their countries. And the Martinez decision expressly applied that to detainees in Mr. Hernandez's situation where he can't.
So they're trying to limit the Supreme Court's opinion.
Yes, definitely are trying to limit that. And I think one of the things also that I find interesting in this whole situation is that in the Tenth Circuit, and actually in the District of Kansas in the District Court, the court found that there was an acceptable set of circumstances under which Mr. Hernandez could be released that had medical input in it, and it was a decision for bond, basically conditions that the INS should and could impose.
If he's housed at Marion currently, would there be anything to prevent the Illinois Attorney General from initiating civil commitment proceedings upon his release?
If he is released in Illinois, I don't know that they can do civil commitment, but they can require him to register and follow those procedures, which are also dictated that the state follow under the Adam Walsh Act?
He was previously convicted in the state of New Jersey.
Of New Jersey.
Does New Jersey have any jurisdiction, or is there any statute in New Jersey that would allow New Jersey to deal with this?
I don't believe that New Jersey has any jurisdiction because all terms of parole and finality of sentence have been completed, so they have no method to get him back to New Jersey.
Could New Jersey have acted at an earlier stage when he was still in their custody, at least in parole status?
I don't believe in the early 1980s that New Jersey or any states had the appropriate legislation in place to do this. This has been something that has been developed in the, I can't tell you exactly when, but I believe in the 1990s was when Kansas adopted theirs, and that case went to the Supreme Court, and that was one of the first to actually go up. So I don't think that they probably would have had the ability to do anything at that point in time. And it's interesting, the INS actually had the opportunity to have Mr. Hernandez housed in a state facility. In fact, some of the case law relied on in this case indicates that the INS has done that previously, and we wouldn't be here having this argument, discussion. But we are.
So,
and so we're stuck having to figure out what custody means.
Doesn't it make logical sense to interpret custody to mean physical custody? Because those in physical custody, are in the best position to assess whether that individual is a candidate for civil commitment and are the ones that have been providing the mental health treatment to that point.
In this instance, no. I would go back to the program statements that were referenced by counsel earlier. And, yes, those do give day-to-day control to the Bureau of Prisons. But if you read those program statements, first they note that Mariel Cuban detainees are in a unique position, but they also give a finality of all decisions to the INS. The INS decides ultimately whether those individuals are released. If somebody escapes from custody who is simply there on an INS detainee, they don't inform the U.S. Marshals or the FBI.
So you're not saying we don't have jurisdiction, are you?
No, I'm not saying you don't have jurisdiction. I'm saying he's not in custody of the BOP for purposes of the Adam Walsh Act. And I think if you look at the language of the statute, that it's very clear that it's a limited statute. It includes three types of persons. And if you look at the legislative background of that, and I think that Judge Gilbert did an excellent job of including that in his memorandum opinion, it was very clear that when they did this, they were trying to close loopholes in 4246, which only applied to, first of all, the second and third categories of persons that are in 4248. The first category in 4246, however, was limited to persons who had been sentenced and hospitalized. And there are a lot of people who had been sentenced but not hospitalized that they were concerned about. That's what was targeted in 4248. And I think that, as I said, that Judge Gilbert covered that very well in his memorandum opinion.
Why is Mr. Hernandez Arenado so unique? I mean, if we've got more than one of these, you know, Mariel Cuban
I actually
individuals.
Don't think he's that unique. The government would say this would apply to one of 12 Mariel Cubans. I say it applies potentially to anybody who is a material witness, who is brought in on a writ to testify in federal court, anybody who's found in civil contempt. Judge Evans gave an excellent example when he mentioned that case falling apart and suddenly you get somebody certified. So the expansive reading that the government seeks to impose in this case is not limited to Mr. Hernandez. He is not the one and only individual this applies to.
No, my question was more pointed toward the other Mariel Cuban individuals in
not
his
knowing,
same boat, so to speak.
Not knowing their history, I don't know if there are any other Mariel Cubans that they are seeking to certify. This is a little unusual in that this is the only certification case that's been brought in our district. The majority of these are handled in two other districts in the country. So I don't actually have information indicating that there are any other Mariel Cubans that they are concerned about because based on a conviction or history.
What happens to this fellow if, let's say, the habeas case is affirmed in the Court of Appeals. And this decision is affirmed. The doors are opened up at the prison, and after 24 years now, he walks out when there's a possibility here that he's a very dangerous sexual predator.
Except that the doors don't just open. Then the conditions placed upon his release by the court in Kansas are instituted, and they are very specific, that he live in a retirement community, that everybody that he resides with be informed of this problem, that he be involved in counseling, that he undergo polygraph examination, and that he be considered for medication that would depress his sexual desires. So there were, I believe, 10 specific qualifications. Well, there's no indication
not,
that
he's,
won't...
If he contests that and says, you know, I'm not a sexual predator. I've been in this prison 24 years. I'm perfectly fine. Why doesn't he go through this procedure that the government wants him to go through now, be found not to be a sexual predator, and then he's released?
I think we're treading on dangerous ground when we begin to say, well, we have concerns, so we want to apply to you a law that does not apply to you. And I think that that's an area where we really shouldn't be expecting Mr. Hernandez or anybody else who might fall under the government's definition of custody to go. Our laws are designed to apply to specific facts, scenarios, and persons.
I mean,
and
even
he's
if,
not there.
Even if this is reversed, you have an opportunity, he has an opportunity to contest an allegation that he's sexually dangerous. Right?
An opportunity which continues his detention when it would not otherwise have to, which violates, as we noted, his right to due process. I see that I'm out of time if there's no
other. If you have something more to say, say it, because I'm going to give Ms. Chaffetz some more time.
Well, Your Honor, I did want to point out that I do think this court has decided that there is a difference between habeas petitioners and the issue of custody and the question of where those bringing habeas petitions are detained, and that does cover a wide variety of persons who are convicted and persons who are not. And Kolieski in the Seventh Circuit, I think, goes to the essence of the problem when it notes that people often try to conflate the issue of immediate custody and the person having control over that custody. The INS has the control over the custody of Mr. Hernandez. The BOP simply institutes the day-to-day oversight of that, as is very clear in the program statement. There are no other questions?
You're sure you're done?
Your Honor, I believe we've covered the issue of custody very well. If you have no further questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to give Ms. Chaffetz another 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Well, you don't have to run up.
This is not part of her 3 minutes. I always think about that because the thing goes on and...
Well, she talks fast enough. She can get 20 minutes of argument in 10. So.
I will try to go a bit more slowly.
Let me ask you this. Yeah. As there's a new Castro in charge of Cuba, why doesn't the government... Has the government gone and said, you want to take some of these people back? That's the whole problem here, isn't it?
I cannot answer as to the very current status of any ongoing negotiations. The Detention Services Branch of the Bureau of Prisons does take responsibility for ongoing attempts, or to the extent that attempts are ongoing, to repatriate individuals who are long-term detainees, whether Cuba or other countries that are declining to accept persons. And I would
well,
like...
Well, this boat lift, if I remember right, it was a lot of people, they just opened the prisons up and put people on them and send them over here, didn't they?
Yes, back in 1980. And in fact, as the program statement notes, in 1980, when this occurred, the Attorney General directed the Bureau to set aside space for particularly dangerous Mariel Cubans, particularly criminal, mentally ill, and particularly dangerous persons who could not safely be detained elsewhere. So there is this long and special history associated with this class of persons being placed in the Bureau's custody that distinguishes them from other groups who may come in to custody in a more ephemeral nature. I wanted to note the idea, of course, all of this, ultimately the question of where lines might be drawn is a question of congressional intent and what Congress had in mind for the scope of 4248, as well as any other legal concerns, constitutional concerns that might arise in such a case. Opposing counsel noted the parallel between 18 U.S.C. 4248 and 4246. It's actually quite useful to note that for a moment because there is an important textual difference between the statutes that suggests that this particular type of expansion in the term custody was something that Congress intended. 4246 specifically contemplates that it applies to persons in the Bureau's custody whose sentences are about to expire. And 4248, the statute at issue here, does not include that language. It stops after Bureau's custody and does not make reference to any sentences. But really, the critical loophole that Congress sought to address was loopholes in statutes dealing with sexual predators.
Just go a little bit further away from the microphone.
Oh, sorry about that. Is that better? Yes, absolutely. Is that okay? And so the main focus of Congress was an attempt to deal with loopholes in sexual predator laws. Now, those are mostly the province of state law. And so Mr. Hernandez-Arenado is in very many ways exactly the type of person that Congress was most critically concerned with, someone who doesn't have a relationship with state authorities and therefore is likely to not receive the care and treatment he may need once released, and so where it falls squarely to the federal government to take responsibility. I just wanted to address the example that was raised earlier by the panel. I realize the light is going on, but since you raised the question, I think it's worth noting that this is not a penal statute. The Supreme Court explained in Kansas v. Hendricks that this type of scheme is a civil scheme. It's not punitive. It doesn't affix culpability. And because of that, it applies to people in the Bureau's custody as well as persons who are deemed incompetent to stand trial, who have never been convicted of anything, and persons against whom charges are dropped because of their mental state. So the concern here is a forward-looking one. Yes, the statute looks to past history of the individual into determining whether or not they present a sexual danger to the public that requires civil commitment. But this is not a punitive statute, and in align with that, the idea that someone might be in custody if they really fell within the scope of the statute and they had such a relationship as Mr. Hernandez-Arenado does, where he's been in custody for more than 20 years as the result of a criminal conviction for sexually assaulting a child, and they have all of this data with regard to him, the idea that such a person, notwithstanding the underlying detention...
It may be illegally collected data. That's what the Tenth Circuit's going to tell us.
Well, there's no question that up until 2005, certainly there's no question about the legality of his detention. After Clark v. Martinez, what we have is a case that's not directly on point, that deals with a different, type of detention, and now the Tenth Circuit will be asked to discuss the validity of the regulation under which Mr. Hernandez-Arenado is held. So if his detention is unlawful, it would only be unlawful following the Tenth Circuit's decision. Up until now, he's been held pursuant to valid orders by courts. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you both very much for bringing us this impossible case, which will be taken under advisement. Thank you.